The final paper in this panel is by Dr. Seth Graham and is entitled A Russianist's Adventures in Central Asian Cinema.
Analysis of a 2004 Kyrgyz film, a clip of which I will show you in a couple of minutes. And in my analysis, take the often metaphor-laden apparatus of post-colonial studies and other flavors of so-called cultural studies on its own terms. And sort of, I want to demonstrate the pleasure, the danger, and the value of sort of falling in love with the image system, not only of the primary texts we study, films, novels, paintings, songs, etc., but the image systems of our favorite fetishized theorists themselves. So those who aspire to make useful generalizations about contemporary Central Asian cinema must have at least an encounter with concepts articulated by Franz Fanon, Frederick Jameson, and others with respect to cultural production under conditions of post-coloniality. If only to demonstrate, to demonstratively reject those concepts as completely inapplicable to the post-Soviet context. And I'm not arguing that they are inapplicable, but there has been a loud silence, as David Cioni Moore and others have pointed out. About 10 years ago, he wrote, and it's the situation is different now a bit, he wrote that post-colonial discourse is a world system with no theory of its former second world, and discussions of the second world have been were prominent in recent discussions of imperial history of Russia in particular. Nancy Condi recently elaborated on a related lacuna. She writes, while attentive to the predations of the first world in the anti-hegemonic struggles in the third world, post-colonialism was strategically negligent not only of the existence as such of the second world, but even of the presence of the second world as a counter-imperial force in the very third world that was the site of apparently rigorous intellectual investigations. There is a kind of willful blindness to the imprint of the second world on the literature, cinema, architecture, friendship associations, urban planning, political infrastructure, and so forth, of post-colonialism's own subject matter. So in other words, elements of the Soviet bloc revolutionary aesthetic could not help but inspire more or less directly much of the cultural production we have collectively decided to label post-colonial in Africa, Asia, and especially Latin America. For the scholar of post-Soviet culture, this leads to a methodological and theoretical question. How do the artists in a former colonial subject, say Kyrgyzstan, draw on the admittedly rousing tradition of second world art when it is that very second world against which their post-colonial indignation is presumably directed? When I talk about Central Asian cinema, I often refer to Deleuze and Guattari's phrase, the power of the yurt, which is related to their concept of nomadism, an extended metaphor they use to describe a form of consciousness and subjectivity. More specifically, in their work, A Thousand Plateaus, they rail against social, cultural, and philosophical systems that depend on models of trees or roots. Instead, they propose the rhizome, or rat's maze, where intricate paths are dispersed and interconnected without trunk or center, kind of related to John's plasma metaphor yesterday. The nomad is meant to exemplify the unpredictable movement and wildcat production patterns associated with rhizomatic multiplicity. A rhizome, Deleuze and Guattari write in A Thousand Plateaus, ceaselessly establishes connections between semiotic chains, organizations of power, and circumstances relative to the arts, sciences, and social struggles. Any point of a rhizome can be connected to any other and must be. Nomadism and the related concept of orality have been used to distinguish from Hollywood and arthouse cinema, which are sometimes called first and second cinema, to distinguish from these two, third cinema, that is the filmmaking of developing countries, especially former colonies. And Dudley Andrew, if you're interested in reading more about this, has quite an interesting schema where he associates Hollywood film with architecture, arthouse film with writing, and third cinema with orality. Without characterizing Kyrgyzstan as a third world country, or even as a post-colonial in the same way that many other nations are, there are useful parallels to be drawn between post-Soviet Central Asian cinema and the cinema of other emergent nations. There are, however, equally instructive differences. The contemporary Central Asian filmmaker is in critical dialogue not only with so-called first and second cinemas, but also with Soviet cinema. a system of representation, again, against which the post-Soviet filmmaking has exercised a complex combination of resistance and implicit homage. Filmmaking in each of the former republics in Central Asia has been defined by negotiation between the tropes of emerging nationhood and the multiple filmic languages now at the disposal of filmmakers: Hollywood, European cinema, Bollywood, East Asian cinema, and especially in the case of Tajik cinema, Iranian cinema. The expanded reservoir of influences and illusions is analogous to the expanded range of stimuli, icons, discourses, images, belief systems, tropes, so on, to which the post-Soviet consciousness is exposed and from which post-Soviet subjectivity must be constructed. There is a two-way metaphorical link to be drawn between cinematic subjectivity and individual consciousness, and obviously this is not a new idea. And even Deleuze himself makes this explicit when he refers to cinema as an exploration of consciousness. And this is kind of what they meant when with the power of the yurt, that the film allows the film viewer, the subject in the audience, to be a nomad and to travel via the screen and the film apparatus. The image of rhizomatic engagement with extant tropes describes a certain type of post-Soviet cultural production, including in Central Asia, where, as one critic, Gulnara Abikeva, argues, the contemporary subject is defined in variable proportions by four different identities or mentalities: ethnic, that is Kyrgyz, Kazakh, Uzbek, Tajik, Turkmen, Muslim, Soviet, and Western. Again, Dudley Andrew attempts in an article on West African filmmaking to, quote, explore nomadism in cinema by examining this metaphor, the nomad, in its seemingly literal emanations, to let the metaphor expand in the location it spontaneously calls forth. In other words, in films made by and about people from traditionally nomadic cultures. The relevant connection to my topic today is the nomadic origins of the Kyrgyz, symbolized graphically and ubiquitously by the representation of a yurt on the nation's flag, not to mention the symbolic erection of a yurt by demonstrators in front of the parliament building in Bishkek during the Tulip Revolution of 2005. A less obvious link is the metaphor of the tree, going back to Deleuze and Guattari, used often in the cinema of Soviet and post-Soviet Central Asia alike. In Andrei Mikhalkov-Konchalovsky's 1965 film, First Teacher, for example, which was filmed in Kyrgyzstan, but which contemporary Central Asian critics refer to as an anti-Kyrgyz film. In this film, a Kyrgyz village's sole surviving tree is doubly coded as a symbolic vestige of traditional allegiances that Soviet peoples were expected to sever, and as the personal fetish and stubbornness of a backwards-thinking village resident who, in a graphic gesture of severing, takes an axe to the tree in the climactic scene. A tree is representative for Deleuze and Guattari of a perceptually and by extension politically restrictive reliance on and attachment to tradition, to the entrenched past at the expense of an expansive future. And here again we can see the dilemma that I spoke about in at the beginning of my talk, that a lot of the tropes of emergent nationhood that have we've seen in third cinema elsewhere outside the Soviet Empire are more resemble more Soviet film itself than any kind of post-colonial cinema that we might expect from a former Soviet colony. Kyrgyzstan was the last of the Central Asian republics to begin producing feature films. Its studio, Kyrgyz Film, as well as its first feature, appeared only in 1958, more than 20 years after those of Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan, and over 30 years after the first Uzbek feature. The 1960s saw a series of films shot in Kyrgyzstan by directors from other republics, and I've already mentioned one of those. Another well-known one is Larisa Shchibitko's film Heat. By the late 60s, Kyrgyz cinema, as represented by native Kyrgyz filmmakers now, such as Bolat Shamshiyev and Tolomush Okeyev, had developed to the point where it was referred to by the Russian director Sergei Yudkevich only slightly patronizingly as the Kyrgyz miracle. And since independence, there have been a few names that have sort of dominated the nation's film industry. The director I'm going to be talking about today is called Ernest Abdijaparov, and this is the very beginning of his film, The Village Authorities. So the beginning of the film introduces us to several of the characters in this ensemble piece. also to some of the major chronotopes of the community's daily life. The kiosk, the concrete shed that seems to serve as a temporary minaret while the mosque is being built, the police station, the town manager's office, I didn't show you this in the interest of time, and the vehicle-less crossroads that is nevertheless tirelessly patrolled by a traffic policeman. The dramatis personae are choreographed by Abdelzaparov in a series of encounters that illustrate just how various are the strategies adopted for negotiating the four mentalities that I cited earlier by Abikeyeva's idea. For example, an itinerant Jehovah's Witness is put into a jail cell with a local communist. At first, they seem to find common cause thanks to, as the communist puts it, their common enemy. But as they begin to argue over the existence of God, the communist is silenced when his demand for proof is met with a thunderclap. The film blurs distinctions among the concepts of ideology and individual motivation. It does so by depicting the haphazard, often comic, mixing of ideologies by the characters. After a meeting with the Jehovah's Witness, the town manager looks up and asks Jesus for forgiveness, then performs the ritual ablution of the Muslim prayer. Later, when the mullah refuses to perform funeral rites for a suicide, the town manager threatens to convert the entire village to Christianity, as if threatening an unaccommodating vendor with the removal of a government contract. The protagonist's wife wants their teenage son to become a mullah not for religious reasons, but so he will at least be able to earn a decent living performing funerals. In the daily rounds of the village manager and the local policeman, which comprise much of the film, we see both a graphic example of the rhizomatic movement and the extent to which personal motivations and institutional and even ideological interests intersect and flow seamlessly one into the other and back again. The village manager is constantly calling on constituents and receiving visitors, but during his perambulations, twice pauses to gaze clandestinely at the window of a local school teacher, and we never meet her actually as a character. We just see him looking at her window. The policeman has a series of trysts, both on and off duty, and accidentally witnesses the nocturnal theft of a sheep while hiding outside the house of one of his lovers, whose husband has unexpectedly returned home. Although there is a mullah, a folk healer, and a Jehovah's Witness, the spiritual center of the village is arguably the vodka kiosk, which fulfills a function comparable to that of the baobab tree in African film, which has the power to encourage transit among worlds, like vodka. The most spiritual residents of the village are the trio of town drunks who use the vodka they acquire at the kiosk as a conduit not only to altered consciousness, but to the eternal, a realm they conjure via the ritualistic pronouncement of toasts. Even here, though, we see a free association interplay among different layers of metaphor and meaning, and also the individual and the collective. The first toast is poetic, metaphoric, to the ever-suffering, yet ever-forgiving Mother Earth. The words bring the second man to tears, not because he agrees, but because he perceives the word mother literally, lamenting his failure to provide for his own actual biological mother. The third of the trio shifts the referential scope yet again, this time laterally, from the individual to the collective, proposing a toast to our fathers, without whom our mothers would not have given birth to us. The end of the film returns visually to the first metaphor of Mother Earth in the image of sewing, an image embedded in yet another associative level, the socialist realist production film, with its tractors and red flags, and in this case, the flag of Kyrgyzstan, which is red. But the illusion is crucially compromised by the intrusion of a decidedly post-Soviet detail. Most of the crop will go to the town's richest man, a new Kyrgyz, without whose tractor fuel there will be no crop. So Soviet film, in its most institutional form, operated on the principle of a double metaphor. Both the protagonist's biographical arc, and in formalist terms, fabula, and the filmic narrative, sujet, are inscribed on 2,000 or 3,000 meters of film stock, were instructive symbolic rehearsals of an established, and one could say, rooted master narrative. In Abdelzaparov's film, however, the ontogeny on the screen does not recapitulate any phylogeny. Such cinema attends to material that is, as Deleuze puts it, essentially laden with singularities. The individual and the collective on the screen, like the screenwriter at the keyboard and the director behind the camera and at the editing table, are free to draw on, reject, and ignore the extant vestiges of representational systems and to adapt them to individual motivations and aspirations. And so, it never hurts to remind ourselves as scholars, are we. Thank you.